tanda benci. Anak tunggu mono pare baju. Anak tanda benci. Mono pare baju. Masih curas dan aku portas. Anak nasib wakamole maju. Wakamole maju. Wakamole maju. Wakamole maju. Tanda benci. Fono bare baju, wakamole maju, wakamole maju.
Hey everyone, welcome to the True Canacast. This episode's gonna be a little one about my history growing up as a smoker before I started growing. I'm sure I've missed out a lot. It's pretty bizarre talking to yourself, so I'm still getting the hang of this whole solo podcast thing. In time, I'm going to have a lot of guests on, so hopefully this episode will inspire a few of you to remember some stories and get in touch, and then we can do an episode, and it'll be nice to build up a little catalogue of past stories for Prohibition era cannabis use, because those days are going to be long gone soon, and as happy as I'll be to see them gone, I think we should get a record of some of those tales for people in the future to look back at and see how ridiculous things really were. Anyway, let's get on with this episode. Hey everyone, and welcome to this episode of the True Canacast. This is going to be a little solo episode where I'm going to talk about growing up as a smoker in London, what it was like before I started growing, a few little tales of the trials and tribulations of Prohibition era smoking. So hopefully you'll like it and it'll inspire a few of you to hit me up with a few episodes of your own. Back in the day originally, when I was growing up, the first signs of people smoking were always adults that were around the family, you know, like older cousins or my auntie's boyfriends, that kind of thing. So from as young as I can remember, there was always people smoking weed, but you kind of didn't really know it was any different. The giveaway was always that they would roll their own joints. And I remember being really young and seeing someone break up a cigarette to put it into a joint. I'm thinking to myself, why are you breaking a cigarette to roll a cigarette? And that was before I actually realized there was something being added to it to enhance that smoke. So as time went on, I guess it's really when you get older cousins that you start to notice these things and get told about them. It's the same with sex and drugs. Older cousins and brothers are always the ones that kind of give you the heads up and tell you about it. Often it's misinformation, but a lot of the time it's your first real insight into the truth of what adults are really doing. I had some aunties, and one of those was a smoker and also had a boyfriend that was a smoker. And I think when I was around maybe 9 or 10 years of age, that was my first actual experience with cannabis, when my cousin convinced my auntie to let me have a toke on one of her joints when we were going for a walk in the country. It wasn't really the country. It was bushy in Watford, but when you come from London, that's pretty fucking countryside. So yeah, we ended up going on a walk, and at some point during that walk, I was handed a joint and allowed to take a toke on it. As you can imagine, it didn't really have much of an effect, but I think it did kind of spark an interest and a mild fascination that would later grow. So that was it really for me for many years. I tried that joint and then it didn't really come into my psyche again for a few years. It wasn't until I was in secondary school, around the age of maybe 14 or 15 that people started in my own age group using cannabis. And then the fascination became a little bit greater and I started paying more attention. I went to a school in Northwest London in Wembley, and it was quite a multicultural school. There was a variety of different people there. So when it did come to cannabis being available, we were lucky that we had Indians, Pakistanis, Jamaicans. And yeah, as with the food in the area, which was incredible, my favorite foods in the world are Indian and Jamaican. So luckily, those same people would also make sure that they could smoke how they were used to. So you would get that, and there would be often like bud that you knew had come from Jamaica. There would be hash that had come from Morocco. There would be hash that was Pakistani hash. There was Indian hash. And yeah, it was obviously being kids, you were never going to be getting the best quality, but we were seeing those varieties come to us. And at school, I remember certain batches when I was at school. I remember there was one crazy kid that was robbing houses. And because he was robbing houses, he was getting loads of money. And that was allowing them to buy large amounts of weed. So they were buying 9 bars, which is how things come in London. You get things in like ounces, 9 bars, which is 9 ounces, and then kilos. Also, it seems kind of retarded to have to say this, but when we used to buy a draw, which is what we used to call buying some weed or hash, we used to get grams, like a 5 pound draw, a 10 pound draw, or an eighth. And this may seem ridiculous, but an eighth is an eighth of an ounce. It's a weight. It's a denomination of grams. How many grams in an ounce? 28, an eighth, 3.5. is an eighth of an ounce. It amazes me that in the modern era, an eighth has just become a word to describe getting some weed. So people will say to you, oh yeah, my eighths are 2 grams. No, it's not a fucking eighth. If it's 2 grams, you might be charging eighth prices and giving 2 grams, but it's definitely not a fucking eighth if it's 2 grams. Anyway, so this friend of mine was picking up massive amounts of bud. He was getting like 9 bars and half kilos. And yeah, they were just going crazy. And it was the first time I remember some flowers coming with an actual origin attached to it. And it was Colombian bud. And it had a kind of brown kind of appearance to it that was a little bit different to the greener stuff that we'd seen before that would come through Jamaican guys. So yeah, it was interesting to get something that had an origin attached to it. I can't really remember what the high was like. Back then, a lot of things just had you bamboozled and just knocked you for six, even if it did take 20 minutes to pick out the seeds and sticks before you rolled a joint. So yeah, those were some of the early flower experiences. My actual first smoking experiences were with hash. I was a wheeler dealer at school and always tried to make a little bit of extra cash any way I could. So at one point I had a double deck video recorder and I was copying tapes, VHS tapes, and selling them to kids at school, making a little bit of extra pocket money so that I could go to the chip shop and things like that. And then one day I decided, all right, I want to smoke some fucking weed. So I spoke to one of my friends and I told him that I'd swap him. Do you know what? I even remember the exact movie that it was. I think it was Aladdin, the Disney film. I'd done him a copy of that and a few other things. And he done me like a 5 pound draw, which would have been like a gram of Moroccan hash. And he had a Moroccan father. His mum was kind of a free thinking hippie type. And he pretty much got to do whatever he wanted, really. He was smoking from an early age and he'd be able to get hash off of his mum. So it was easy for him to access hash when we were at school. And he hooked that up and I couldn't even roll back then. So I had to ask him to roll all of the joints for me. So that was really the start of my smoking career. He rolled a few joints and yeah, I got into smoking. It's funny because I can actually remember the exact place where that was. Me and my friends, we used to go to this youth activity group that was like a cable television show. It was called YCTV, and that was down in Ladbroke Grove near Wormwood Scrubs, which is like a prison with a big open space. And there was a park near that. And I remember me and my friend, we met my other buddy with the hash and had a smoke before we went to YCTV for the day. So yeah, I remember that day. And my other friend, my best friend at the time, he just watched and you could just see the envy building up in him. So yeah, as I was smoking, he weren't happy about it. As much as I think it's inappropriate for kids to be smoking, I did enjoy it. But a lot of the reason I enjoyed it is because it fucking calmed my brain down. It stopped me from having like a million thoughts and just being a fucking hyperactive, crazy, hormone-ravaged teenager, which is the case of a lot of kids. And sadly, nowadays, they'll try and give those kids Ritalin and all kinds of shit to calm them down. But for me, cannabis really did help my mind focus. And it's a fine line. That's the truth of it. As much as it helped my mind focus, there's the element of cannabis that I know it can't be great for a developing mind. So it's a double-edged sword. And the other element is how sociable it is. As much as it calmed me down and helped me focus and stopped me from fucking around so much at school, there was also that element that you were having so much fun smoking and catching jokes with your friends that you didn't really want to be in class a lot of the time. So when I ended up going to college, it was a little bit more disruptive than it was when I was in secondary school because the social element took over quite a fair bit. So yeah, back to the actual smoking and what I was smoking at that time in London. Back then, we're talking about 1995 now, and there was a lot of Moroccan hash, but also back then there was quite a lot of Indian hash around as well. There was a lot of squidgy black. There was what people would call packy black, which obviously you don't want to be using the word packy a lot, but when it's describing the hash, people would call it that. So it is what it is. It's not a nice word when used inappropriately. It's not one I'd use any other circumstance, but often when describing the hashish from Pakistan, people would refer to it as packy black. But yeah, some of those hashes were good. But at the same time, the quality, as I started smoking, started to wane. It was clear that not all of the squidgy hash was good quality. And over a few years, it slowly started to disappear and dry up off of the market. And before too long, there wasn't really much of that Indian hash available, or Pakistan hash. It was just the Moroccan, which was super readily available where I live, because basically I live close to Ladbroke Grove, which has a massive, massive Moroccan population and therefore has some of the best hash connections anywhere in the world, I would say. One of the things that was a real revelation in the early years of smoking while we're on the subject of hash was hash tea. We never really used to put it into food, but I think it was my best friend at the time. His uncle was a blind guy and we used to love smoking and just getting high with him. He was an incredible character and he showed us about mixing the hash with a fat or an alcohol or something to activate it. So we quickly got into the habit of sticking some hash with a spoonful of butter. We would microwave that and then pour in a cup of tea into that and then drink it and call it hash tea. Oh my God, that was a challenge to eat that, like to drink it down with all the lumps in the bottom sometimes. But my God, that got us so baked. That was like on the levels of psychedelic highs. We really did push ourselves to some limits. As the hash got worse and worse, we used to just eat more and more of it. And some of those experiences make me think that there was more than just hash in that hash, because yeah, there was some crazy, crazy adventures and some real, real like experiences where we had friends freaking out and people having like panic attacks. And yeah, we had quite a few strange experiences where we overdosed other people, not realizing their tolerance wasn't quite up to ours. another thing that was really special was the small batches of hash that would come back with people. If you knew some crazy hippies, and I had a friend that had an extensive network of friends that were always traveling and coming back with interesting flavors. There was never large amounts. It was always swallowed and brought back like that. But you kind of accepted that it was going to be more expensive and you were going to get something super special that no one else had around at the moment. You were always going to pay a little bit more for it, but you didn't mind that because, yeah, it was always just mind-blowing quality. I remember one particular experience, which was like a game changer for me. It was, even to this day, one of the strongest hash experiences I've ever had. What it was is that a guy that I knew had a girlfriend who had been to India for a few months. And when she come back, she got some tolas of some of the most incredible hash I've ever smoked in my life. It was the first time I'd heard the term tola to describe hash. And yeah, this was some of the most incredible hash I've ever experienced. You'll have to excuse the noise in the background. As you know, if you follow me on Instagram, I've got a couple of dogs. One of them named Coco is basically a terrorist to her little sister and is harassing her right now, trying to get a rise out of her to play. So she's going to be in the background making noise, disturbing us for the next few minutes, no doubt. Getting wires. Yes, Coco, I'm going to film you now to make you feel uncomfortable and self-conscious so that everyone on the podcast knows what a terrorist you are. Behave yourself. Sitting on your sister. I'm trying to record a podcast here. No one wants to hear your noise in the background. So behave. And I've just done a little video, so I'll post that on the Instagram so that you can see this little monster if you're not familiar with her. But yeah, back to the hash situation. Yeah, I had a friend. I was very lucky that as a kid, well, let me go back. I lived on a street in a part of Northwest London. And it was such a fun place, so vibrant. And one of the kids that lived on the street, his mum was a true hippie. And because of that, he was a smoker and always had incredible links. So that was where, when I started smoking, he was one of the people I first approached and started going to get flavors from. And he would, like I say, always have the most incredible hash links. And one of the hash links he had was a girl that bought these incredible tolas of Indian hash back. And it was just incredible. The best description I can give it is just spicy. It was the most spicy, potent, just delicious, mouth-watering hash I'd ever had up to that point. Even to this day now, I know we remember things with like fondness and we put greater memory into something from the past. But basically, I can tell you that this was one of the most potent hashes I've ever smoked in my life. It was so potent. I remember going home to my parents' house, and obviously back then I was like 15 or 16 years of age, so smoking in my fucking parents' house wasn't really an option. Although they knew that I smoked, I had to smoke outside out of respect. So I went outside and rolled up some of this hash into a joint with tobacco because I was a tobacco smoker back then. And yeah, this hash was literally some of the most incredible hash I've ever smoked in my life. It made me do what I call an 8 count. I had to take an 8 count and go down on one knee and crouch because my head was spinning from the smoke. And I immediately phoned my friend and told him, like, get whatever money you can get. Get round to T's house and buy up some of this hash because it's going to be gone soon. And when it's gone, we're going to regret not buying as much as we can. And that was kind of always the mentality. As a smoker back in the day, you would search out the best thing and then spend whatever money you had on it to get as much as you could because you were afraid once it ran out, you'd be stuck buying something mediocre again. One of the funniest experiences I had with that same friend was with one of his links that he had, who was an Italian guy. I I'm sure he's an Italian guy, but that was the, it was the first time I ever saw Moroccan hash that really melted. And that was because this crazy guy went over to Morocco on his own, went up into the mountains, got sift, pressed it into eggs, like 5 gram eggs, and then swallowed like 100 of them or something crazy like that. And then came back to England. But the craziest thing of all is not the fact that he swallowed all that hash and brought it back. The crazy thing is that when he's in Morocco, he sees some kids terrorizing the lizard and decides to save the lizard from these kids and ends up bringing the lizard back in his suitcase to England. So when my friend goes and sees him, he's in the house. He's fucking super stoned because 2 or 3 of the eggs haven't come out of him. So now he's in like a semi-hash coma and he's got this fucking lizard in the house. So my friend went and picked up a bunch of hash off of him. He's telling me about this lizard that he's got. The next time he spoke to the guy, he had been so stoned, he was worried that he couldn't care for the lizard. So he thought it was a sensible decision to take it to a park and release it. Fuck knows where this guy thinks he is, because he's obviously not too familiar with the climate in Northwest London, especially at this time of year, because literally when my friend heard that, he told him like, bro, it won't survive. It's going to die. And the dude went back to the park and said that he found a lizard like less than 100 meters from where he tried to set it free. So yeah, that was pretty fucked up. The geezer not only risked bringing all that hash back, but brought back a lizard only to set it free and see it fucking die in the park. So yeah, that guy was, he always had such adventurous, quirky, unique people coming by the house. That's the first time that I actually saw like an egg of Moroccan hash. And when someone put a flame to it, it didn't just have like a little simmer, it properly bubbled and melted. And that was one of the most special batches of hash we ever saw for many, many years. That was like, gave us an insight to a whole new level of what was possible.
That's some heavy shit, man.
When I started smoking, it's funny, my actual start to smoking was an interesting one, because although I started, like I said, with my friend who made the hash joints for me, and I swapped him some VHS videos. What actually happened after that was, hold on one moment. Coco, sit down and behave yourself, please. I don't need you fucking around right now. Sorry about that, guys. I had to pause for a moment there. This dog is going crazy, making so much noise and bumping into me. It's going to fuck up the podcast if I don't tell her to stop. So yeah. All right, let me go back a few steps, because as with any stoner, I'm fucking jumping all over the place with this background story of how I started smoking and what it was like growing up in London as a smoker. I started smoking and it was pretty infrequent. You know, it'd be like maybe once or twice a week, someone would come in with something. I'd save up £2.50 and go halves on a £5 draw with one of my friends. It was always an effort to even smoke a joint because I couldn't roll one. So I had to have a smoking partner whenever I was going to smoke. That didn't last too long though. I soon fucking learned to roll joints. But to begin with, I wasn't smoking much. And then after a couple of months of the odd little smoke here and there, my best friend basically snitched on me. He was so jealous that I was smoking and that he was too afraid to try it and get in trouble that he snitched on me to his mum, which was fucking super awkward because basically our mums and dads were best friends. So one day I go to pick him up from school to jump on the bus and go into Wembley. We lived in Halsden, Northwest London, and used to get on the infamous 18 bus to Wembley. If anyone knows that bus, that was peak back in the day. It would always be people on the back at the top smoking weed. But yeah, I went to meet him and his mum asked me to come into a room and speak to her. And then bam, it was on top. She had been told that I was smoking weed and basically approached me in a way that, to be fair to her, was the best possible way. She approached me and kind of said like, listen, I know that you're smoking cannabis. It's not appropriate. You're a kid. It's not the worst thing in the world, but your brain's growing, you're developing, and you're meant to be learning at school, not fucking around smoking weed. So stop doing it. I won't tell your parents, just don't do it again, and we won't have an issue. So me, I was counting my lucky stars that she weren't going to snitch on me to my family. So literally at that moment, I stopped smoking cannabis. As hard as it was, I stopped. And there were hard times. Like, I had friends I used to smoke with by this stage, and I was the one rolling the joints for them. But now, because I wouldn't smoke, they would still buy weed and ask me to roll the joints. So there was a little period of me being at school, maybe 3 or 4 months, where everyone else was smoking. And even if I was rolling the joints and being around with them, even if I was hooking up the bud, calling my buddies to get it, all of that, I was still a spectator and just watching, because, yeah, I didn't want to get snitched on to his mum again, and kind of felt myself lucky that I hadn't got in trouble from my parents. So that was it. I had a little hiatus of no smoking. And then one day I go into school and that very same friend approaches me looking all excited, only to tell me that him and his cousin had got permission from his parents and had been smoking fucking weed all weekend. So as you can imagine, I'm thinking to myself, what a cheeky bastard. You snitched on me 3 or 4 months ago, and now you're fucking smoking at home with permission of your parents. And the funniest thing of all was that his dad used to grow a couple of plants in the back garden, and that was the fucking weed that they were smoking. So not only had the same parents that had told me to stop smoking allowed their fucking children to smoke, but they were providing them with the cannabis to do it. So as you can imagine, I had serious FOMO, fear of missing out, if you're not familiar with the term. And yeah, I immediately wanted to ask my parents if I could smoke. So that's exactly what I fucking did. It was approaching Christmas time now, and I literally hit my parents up and said to them, like, look, so-and-so, name removed for the protection of the innocent. Yeah, he has asked his parents to start smoking and they've allowed it. Can I too? So my parents had a lot of fucking discussion to do. And after some deliberation, they came back to me and they allowed it. And the reality of it was that my parents were, neither of them were smokers. They were pretty comfortable with cannabis and they didn't think it was necessarily a bad thing, but they weren't smokers. So it was a very, very unusual thing for them to do. But I think they, one, appreciated the honesty, but two, they were influenced by their friends who had allowed their children to do it. And growing up, that's the way things often were, is that if it was good for one of the kids, it was good for all of the kids. So if one of us was going to swimming lessons and the other wanted to go swimming, it was easy to convince the parents. So when it comes to smoking cannabis, I managed to do the same thing. So that Christmas, I officially started smoking with permission from my parents. And I got to be honest with you, it was probably one of the wisest things they did, because it built a relationship, a trust. I'd always been encouraged to be honest with my dad, and lying about smoking for that little period that I had done was kind of ate me up inside. I'd always been super honest with my dad, no matter how much I fucked up. He always told me, like, look, there's no mistake that you can't come back from. But if you lie, that makes you a liar. And being a liar is your character. And breaking those characteristics is hard because it's who you become. So for me, being honest was always a very important thing. So to start again on this honest footing and telling him that I was smoking was something that I was happy about doing. And I felt much more comfortable and was able to actually smoke and enjoy it and not have the paranoia that's associated with cannabis. People tell you that cannabis will make you paranoid, but I'll tell you, lying, hiding it from people and fearing the law will make you paranoid. Cannabis will just enhance that. When you're having fun and relaxing, is all it does is make you have fun and relax. It's an enhancement drug. That's what I always tell people. It enhances your emotions and a lot of feelings. So if you can get the set and setting right and really enjoy yourself, then it's possible to enjoy cannabis. Sorry, I've got to open a container now and the shit's going to make noise. So such is life. Hopefully some of you are trimming too and you can kind of feel my pain. if you're someone that doesn't trim and you're getting annoyed by me making noise trimming and opening the boxes, then I suggest you try trimming a few plants and realize that it's a monotonous task. And if you can get something else done at the same time, it sure is helpful. So yeah, I started smoking with my friends then. It was him and a cousin of his. His mum had adopted a couple of cousins, so they also lived with him. My friend was a year older than me and his cousin was a year older than him. So the three of us started smoking and it became kind of our ritual that every weekend we would smoke. And at that time, their father or uncle for one of them, he used to actually grow some cannabis plants in the back garden. He would grow them. And although he was hardly a smoker himself, what he used to love was just giving out the flowers to friends that were smokers. So every year he would harvest a few plants, dry them, and then just give it out to a few friends that he knew were smokers. And then he'd save himself a few buds and secretly smoke them when his wife had gone to bed and all the kids had gone to bed and he was on his own. He'd have a secret little smoke. So yeah, we were very lucky at this stage of our smoking that every weekend we would go to the parents and ask them if we could have some weed, and they would give us a bag. And basically they didn't have no idea what you needed to smoke. They had no clue about quantity or weight or how much was suitable. So they were giving us massive bags between three of us that would last us way more than the weekend, luckily. And then what we would do when it got to the end of the weekend, we were able to split it up and have a few joints to last us between throughout the week. And the thing is, this is essential for us at the time because sadly, we're in a situation in England where we've been taught that smoking cannabis, you need to mix tobacco with it. So the sad reality is that as soon as we started smoking joints and smoking cannabis, we inadvertently became tobacco addicts. So now what you're finding is that rather than just smoking on the weekend, we're getting a nicotine craving that we're having to try and appease during the week, as well as liking to be high. That I ain't going to lie and say it was all about a nicotine craving. It was primarily about being stoned and the altered state of consciousness that we like to put ourselves in. But at the same time, there is that element. So basically we would have this bud and we would smoke like fucking crazy people. We would literally sit in the house on the weekend in the smoking room because the house was being renovated. So we were lucky that we didn't even have to smoke outside because it would just draw attention with smoke going everywhere. So we were actually allowed to smoke in the house. So for my teen years, we were very, very lucky. And we had this whole situation where weekends we'd be at my buddy's house and we'd just have smoke sessions and just smoke ourselves into oblivion. I remember so many times being so high that I could literally couldn't move and getting one of my other friends to like bring me bread with just butter on it. Do you know what? I'll be honest, there were times when I ate dry bread where I was so high as a kid and so hungry and there's nothing in the house and you're not allowed to eat certain shit because you'll get in trouble if you fucking raid the cupboards. So you're left with nothing but bread and you're eating bread and fucking enjoying it. I tell you, I think back to being like 15 years of age and there were times I genuinely enjoyed eating dry bread, being stoned out of my mind. And yeah, those times were just epic. I remember like when you're a kid, you're so broke that you don't even have no cigarettes. So we'd be getting weed and we'd have these bags of weed, but we'd have no cigarettes and we hardly got any money. So we'd be going outside to the bus stop and trying to catch someone smoking at the bus stop and ask them for a piece of cigarette. And you kind of like would have to pick the right person. You'd kind of like think to yourself, like, this guy looks like he might smoke weed. If I ask for a piece of cigarette, he might be sympathetic and know that we're smoking some weed and give us a little cigarette or a piece of cigarette at least. So that was the move. And also we'd go down to Lloyd's. Anyone who lives in Harlesden, Northwest London, they know about Lloyd's on Craven Park. Lloyd is a legend. He used to sell the single cigarettes back in the day. Man, we used to be there all the time. Them singles were a lifesaver. And also back in the 90s, yeah, anyone will know that you used to be able to buy cigarettes when you was a kid. Yeah, you used to be able to go into a shop And if they knew your parents, you could just tell them like, yeah, can I get 20 fucking Benson and Hedges? It's for my dad. And they will just take that on board. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, wicked. Because a lot of the time it was, you would get sent to the shops to buy cigarettes for an adult. So when you come in and did it for yourself, there was no really qualms about it. So we'd go in there and get singles and be able to like spread that out as long as we could to fucking to smoke.
Let that sucker up, man. We'll go to the moon.
So yeah, basically for the first few years, maybe the first year, I would say, yeah, it would have only been a year. For the first year of smoking, it was import commercial flowers. And also it was hash. We were getting hash at those points mostly, but there was import flowers. One of the best import flowers I ever had in my life came when I was at school. I was maybe 16. We're talking 1996, coming towards doing my GCSEs. I used to have two friends that always would smoke with me, one Somalian girl and one Chinese girl. And luckily, they always used to have money and used to buy flowers, but they love me. So they always used to pick me to come and smoke with them. So I'd always roll the joints. I'd most of the time hook up the bud and then we'd go and smoke and they would smoke like maybe a third of the joint between them. And I'd smoke the other two thirds and be blazed out of my mind. Those two people know who they are. If they ever listen to this, they'll be laughing because, yeah, we used to have some good times. And I remember one of the times I called one of my friends and he came and dropped us some flowers. And this was like some African bush, what we used to call mersh. Mersh was the word, M-E-R-C-H. But it was an abbreviation for commercial bud. That was like what they import pressed in America. You get like Mexican import, that was what we called ours. It was mersh. And my friend came and he had some African bushweed that it was nothing special to look at. Everything's always compressed and dark and has seeds and twigs in it. But I'm telling you, this weed to this day was the most frightening experience I've probably ever had from any drug in my life. And I've experimented later in life with a few different drugs. So for me to say that, yeah, it's something. And I remember we smoked this joint and like any smokers, yeah, once they're high, the girls just want to go. So now they're kind of looking at me to hurry up with the joint. So it ends up being my section of the joint getting speed smoked, rushing out of there to go and grab some chips. So as we go towards a chip shop, I start feeling a little bit peculiar and I can feel like my vision, everything's getting super, super bright. So I'm thinking, rah, I'm starting to have a fucking whitey. This is not feeling good. I've never had a whitey before, but I've heard the term and I'm thinking, fuck, I need to sit down. This is peak and I do not want to freak out in front of these two girls and make a mug of myself. So while they go into the chip shop, I fucking walk over to the bus stop and sit down. Literally, by the time I get to the bus stop, I just managed to sit down in time for my fucking vision to go completely white. Like if you've had a whitey before, you've probably not had a real whitey because this was the definition of a whitey. Everything fucking went white. I could not see. There was some kind of like pressure on my optic nerve that felt so strange. I could feel the pressure in my head behind my eyes and literally everything was bright white. So I'm sat at the bus stop and I'm freaking out inside thinking, fuck, what am I going to do? This is nuts. I've gone blind, but I don't want to freak out too much. I think in the back of my mind, part of me was calm because I knew that it's cannabis. Nothing can really go wrong. So I knew that whatever this was, it was going to be temporary. So there was a part of me that was trying to remain calm with that thought in the back of my head. So I sat down at the bus stop and then I just kept hearing air brakes. You know, if you know what a double-decker bus sounds like, when it pulls up, it just goes as the air brakes stop and it kind of lowers down. And I kept hearing that sound and thinking, okay, let me open my eyes. Maybe it's my bus. And as I opened my eyes, everything was white again. So I'm like, oh, fuck. I can't cope with looking and seeing everything white. It was freaking me out. So I just decided, let me close my eyes for a few minutes and I'll wait until the girls come out. Hopefully I'm fucking able to see by then, or otherwise they're going to have to guide me home and get me to my house or a fucking hospital. So I waited. Now, it's felt like an eternity, but now we're probably talking no more than like a minute, maybe a minute and a half, something like that. I'm sat there. I've opened my eyes and closed my eyes maybe half a dozen times. And as I'm sitting there with my eyes closed, I can gradually feel the pressure behind my eyes start to release. So I kind of wait for a moment and then I think, all right, let me open my eyes. And as I open my eyes, my vision was like the reverse of an old school telly when you turn it off. Instead of everything fading to a tiny little white dot, everything started as a little black dot in the white. And slowly that little black dot opened up and my vision started to come back. And within a moment, everything was fucking visible again. And I took a big sigh of relief. See that my bus hadn't come yet, which was even better because everyone was still waiting. And then within a couple of seconds, the girls came back out. And as you can imagine, I weren't going to mention it. So I just fucking shut my mouth and carried back on with my day. And that one pretty much stayed with me till now. And I always think back about that. And I'm still to this day searching for those African genetics that have that effect that will just fucking freak out your optic nerve and just do some crazy shit to you. The only other time I've ever experienced anything like that is when I'd done ketamine. And literally my vision was upside down. And that lasted maybe 5 or 10 minutes where everything I was looking at was upside down. And that was that was not as frightening an experience it should have been, because I just thought back to the time I went blind on Wembley High Street as a 15-year-old and figured, nothing's as frightening as that. So yeah, that was one of my terrifying childhood experiences. Most of them were just pleasurable though. Me and my friends would just fucking finish school, get a £5 draw between us, £2.50 each, and just smoke down the alleyway after school. That was the routine for many years. And then eventually I would go on to college, and that's when my smoking really, really got crazy. Like, at school, I would smoke a lot and our parents knew we were smoking, so that made things easier. Eventually, smoking on the weekends turned into smoking on the weekdays all of the time as well. And that's another funny story I got to tell you. It was probably 6 months into smoking that I started smoking during the weekdays even more. And eventually, because of the nicotine addiction, it got to the point where I'm smoking joints before school. So pretty much every day, like with the bud that we'd save from the weekend, I'd kind of ration out my flowers for the week so that I had like a joint during the day and then two for the evening, like one after school and one in the nighttime. And they were minuscule amounts of bud in them, but they were really just to fucking keep back the tobacco craving. When I think back how much I smoked as a kid, it was just incredibly bad because of all the tobacco that was smoked. If I could have been a pure smoker, I would have been smoking so much less, because you have the opportunity to choose when you smoke. But being a kid, not really understanding how all these things work on your body and your brain and how the cravings affect you and things like that, you end up getting caught into an addiction of smoking that, as someone that was always, I don't smoke cigarettes, and it's so weird, you have this kind of feeling of like, oh, I'm better than you as a cigarette smoker because I only smoke weed, but I'm smoking cigarettes with my weed. So it was crazy to be like that. But as a kid, you are naive, and it takes time to realize that nicotine addiction and how it affects you negatively. And it takes even more time to get your head around that and decide that you're going to break away from it. But as a kid, I would get up and have a joint rolled and go smoke that before school and then head to school nice and stoned and get on with my day. And it made me less disruptive. At school, teachers said I was over opinionated and disruptive, but a lot of the time it was because I was just fucking bored and probably borderline ADHD as well, because my attention was just fucked. I couldn't focus on things. I was either really good at stuff and I got it straight away, or if I couldn't, I just gave up and was just fucking messing around, disrupting the class and being a smart ass, looking for cheap laughs and things like that. Because anyone knows that when you go to a fucking a mad school, being funny is a pretty good self-defense mechanism as well. If you make people laugh, you avoid a lot of problems as a kid, and I always was good with that. So yeah, at school, I would smoke before I got to school. And I remember one morning I woke up, rolled a joint, went out the house, and my dad would drive one way to school. So what I would do is go down a little one-way street where I knew he would never drive because it's opposite way to where he's going to school with my little sisters. So I was stood in like literally the archway of a wall surrounding a church. And as I'm standing there smoking a joint, my fucking dad and my two sisters walk around the corner, completely surprise me and catch me smoking. So yeah, my dad luckily is one of the fucking nicest human beings I've ever had the pleasure of coming into contact with. I'm super blessed to have him. And for someone who's a non-smoker, he was just so cool about it. He literally just said to me like, what the fuck are you doing smoking on the street? Don't be so stupid. If you're going to smoke, smoke in the fucking back garden where no one's going to see you. Don't do it out here. Risk getting yourself nicked or in trouble by someone or seen by the wrong person. And yeah, just fucking, it was another one of those situations where it's just a reality check, and it dawned on me even more how fucking legit my dad was, and just made our bond even stronger because it took away another element where I was fucking hiding something from him and secretly smoking, because at the end of the day, it's not something I was ashamed of, but you just don't feel that you should be doing those things, especially as a kid. And yeah, it's just a weird one to deal with. I feel sorry for any adult who has kids now at that age, because I remember what I was like, and it's such a fucking difficult thing to navigate as a parent, to know like, is it suitable for my child to smoke? Because at the end of the day, we all know that the English mentality is to just let your kids drink when they get to a certain age. It's sociable. I remember being able to drink alcohol from a very young age. That's like, it's nothing for you to be like 12, 13, 14, to be drinking shandies, or to be allowed one drink on holiday, or to be allowed sips out of people's glasses. It's like, for sure, I remember being under the age of 10 and being drunk as a kid by finding irresponsible adults at parties and asking them for sips of their drink, to the point where you've drunk so much you're a fucking child and you're paralytic drunk and you're being sick. And I remember that as a kid. So sometimes when I think about the situation where parents are having to navigate the subject of their children using cannabis, it's such a difficult one, because I don't really think it does that much harm. It's like, I really do think you should wait until your brain's developed. I think 18 is a good age. But at the same time, if you're the kind of person that's going to share a fucking beer with your kid when they're 16 or 17, then I don't see why they can't smoke a joint. It's just important to make sure that they're not doing it with tobacco and using it and becoming an addict to tobacco, which in turn makes them habitual cannabis smokers. Because that is unhealthy, and that's when it becomes a problem for people of a young age. But for me, like I say, my parents were pretty cool with it. I was always honest with them when I fucked up and when I did things wrong. So when it come to doing something like this, they were happier that I was maintaining that honesty with them, and they knew that I was doing it safely in a house, not out on the street surrounded by all kinds of craziness. Because yeah, I live in an area of Northwest London where things are pretty peak. And you could be outside and some crazy shit happen, whether it be another person or the police or any number of things. So yeah, as a smoker growing up, I was quite lucky, and me and my friends had quite a fun time over the years of being in a safe environment and being able to smoke. And like I say, we had a good supply of cannabis for a long time as well. So that made life super, super fucking easy for us. It wasn't for a while that we had to start buying our own things when we started to really smoke more, and we couldn't get the flowers that his dad had grown to last us, or the crop run out. And then all of a sudden we were stuck with having to afford cannabis, which was a shock to the system, because his parents didn't have any idea what we needed. So they were giving us huge bags of bud that would last us a week. And then when the crop ended and we had to start buying things, we had to start learning about rationing. And I remember I used to go to school and I'd get £3 for my lunch money. And out of that £3, I would buy a pack of Maryland cookies for 50 pence. And then the other 2.50 would go halves on a £5 draw with one of my friends. So that would be it. I'd eat a packet of cookies at school and that would be it. I'd be more worried about having a fucking £5 draw with my friends so that I could smoke and come home and have a draw, and then I'd eat at home. My poor parents were just feeding me like crazy. As I became an adult, I realized how much food I was fucking eating as a kid, and even more so once I started smoking, because I was spending the money they gave me for food on weed that was making me eat more food, and I was coming home and eating all of their food. So yeah, I'm sympathetic to parents that have got fucking children with the munchies, because kids eat enough as it is on a normal day. They've got no respect for fucking what shopping costs most of the time. You're pretty oblivious as a kid how difficult life is. So yeah, I'm sympathetic to those days when I would just raid the cupboards and just eat everything and anything. But like I say, my parents were very, very cool about it. So I was lucky not to get too much of a headache about those kind of things. As time went on, some very interesting things happened. I remember one day, my best friend who I was smoking with back then, he phoned me and said, "Bro, we've got some weed here. It's the most incredible thing I've ever smoked in my life. It feels like my head's a balloon on a string and it's floating above my body. It's called skunk." And that was it. The revolution began. And all of a sudden, one of his older cousins had a friend and he had bought some skunk from someone that was just mind blowing. I remember it being so much more expensive than everything else. I think it was like £5 a gram if you bought any other flower, and you could get it for less if you bought more. So you'd get eighths for like £15 or eighth for £10 of hash or flowers. And then all of a sudden there was skunk and it was £10 a gram. And it didn't matter how much you bought, it was still £10 a gram. But oh my God, it stunk. It was so incredible. We never knew what the strains were back then. It just came with the generic name skunk. If you're from England or you know anything about the scene in England, the media has used the word skunk as an umbrella name for super strength, psychoactive, turns you crazy cannabis. So that's their scaremonger word. They like to refer to everything as skunk. So that's the kind of term that we were using back then. But really what it referred to was homegrown modern cannabis strains grown in climate control, you know, with proper lights and not import bush, dried outdoors, compressed with seeds and sticks. That was the other thing. Skunk was seedless. It was sensimilia. The only time we'd really had sensimilia before then was from certain Jamaicans that would get cessed. They would have sensimilia that was referred to as cessed by the Jamaicans. And that was super expensive as well. If you got cessed back in the 90s, it was crazy prices, often more expensive than even skunk, because a lot of the Jamaicans didn't want to smoke the skunk. They were terrified that it was chemical weed and that it was poison and it was bad for them. So they would pay a lot more money for cessed. And that was just basically the same flowers grown outdoors in Jamaica that's then compressed and imported. So yeah, those were some of the interesting flavors we would get as well from some Jamaican guys. I had a cousin and her boyfriend was in North London, and he had some real good links for some interesting flowers back in the day. There was a whole bunch of good import from the Jamaicans, a whole bunch of cessed, but he also used to get a whole lot of good stuff from growers. He was one of the first people that was getting like the super silver haze and that was in North London, and the white rhino. And yeah, he was one of the people when I first started growing that was getting good flavors, but Cest was available. That was one of the main imports. And I used to love a good bit of Cest, but it was always super expensive because the rusters had kind of put a premium on that because that's all they wanted to smoke. So you kind of had to bite the bullet and pay more for it. So over the years of smoking flowers, the kind of evolution that occurred is that when skunk and the modern strains came into the scene, what was also happening at that time was that the hash market was getting super, super bad. It was really poor, and what you were finding was a lot of contaminated hash. There was a craze where you were getting something called henna, which is some kind of hair coloring or some kind of adulterant that they were putting in with hash to bulk it out. And as well as that, you would literally get lumps of plastic in it sometimes. And there was all kinds of scaremongering stories where they were saying that they were getting out-of-date pharmaceuticals and they were crushing it down and mixing it in with the resin to make it more potent. So sadly, the hash market really dwindled. Places like Pakistan and Afghanistan, where we were seeing so much hash from in the early 90s and mid-90s, slowly started to fade away. The Pakistani hash almost become extinct, so did the Afghani hash. All of the squidgy varieties and the hand-pressed tolas just weren't available anymore. And that was heartbreaking. You were just getting Moroccan, and the Moroccan quality was so up and down, it just got to the point where by the late 90s, you didn't really want to smoke hash no more. You were burnt so many times by bad experiences. You would get lumps of hash that literally you would warm it to break it up. And by the time you put your finger on it and tried to crumble it, it had burnt your finger and turned rock solid again. You would end up giving yourself fucking blisters on your fingers from trying to break the hash up. And the hot rocks were just ridiculous. Anyone in England will know hot rocks ruined a whole generation of kids' fucking clothing and got them in trouble by their parents, because you'd go out smoking hash and there would be so many hot rocks just pouring out of it. What you call hot rocks are like whatever contaminant it is that's left in it that just glows super hot where it's fucking not going to burn and just turns into like little miniature coals and just falls out and burns holes in every item of clothing you've got. I still got friends to this day that have got like nostalgic jackets and things like that where they can show you like a sea of hot rock burns where loads fell. I remember even in my car, the ceiling had hot rock burns in it from driving around smoking hash, and when you would flick it out the window, it would blow back in and burn holes in the fucking ceiling. And I know a bunch of people that had that as well. I know two friends that had metros with fucking loads of burn holes in their ceiling. It was super crazy how much the hash just damaged everything. Aside from being poison, it was a fucking health risk just to try and smoke it without getting burnt. So a lot of people moved away from the hash market, which is kind of sad really, because there was so much good hash being close to Ladbroke Grove and the huge Moroccan population that lived there, that we were lucky to be connoisseurs of hash. So for it to go the other way was super sad. But for some reason, it appears that when there's something shit being sold, the UK market are always the last ones to fucking say no. And they end up continuing to buy it and polluting the market. So it happened with soap bar for a long time, and it happened when gritweed came along. And the gritweed is something that I never had to deal with, luckily, because I was growing by them. But that was when they were spraying everything from sugars to fucking lead shavings to all kinds of fucking materials and dust. And I even heard of people at the time putting like iron shavings and yeah, just super, super toxic, terrible stuff that's just got to be so dangerous for people. So yeah, that happened for a good while, but sadly that's always the situation. Over the years, we noticed that as cannabis become more popular and started to make more money, more gangsters and criminals got involved and did stupid, careless money grabbing activity like cutting things and adding crap to it and just making it unusable by anyone who's got a fucking half a brain and doesn't want to poison themselves. So yeah, basically there was the hash that would come in. Although we didn't know any growers, there were growers around, and later in life you would kind of realize, looking back at certain things that you had, you would realize that that came from a grower. Back then, homegrown was like a disrespect. If something looked homegrown, it meant that it wasn't quite as well grown as the skunks. It meant like someone had done it in their bedroom and they didn't have respect for that. Everyone kind of thought that you needed a laboratory and you were a commercial grower and that all the good bud came from massive scientific facilities. So when someone said homegrown, it had negative connotations for a little while, but slowly growers got better, and all of a sudden you would notice the skunks and these kind of new fancy Sensimilia indoor grown strains would start to pop up even more and more. And you would notice that people were getting better at growing them. And all of a sudden the tag of homegrown being bad kind of faded away. And then it was just good weed and no one really even mentioned whether it was homegrown or not. That kind of tag as like a negative connotation slowly faded away. And I guess now homegrown is boutique growers, because as big cannabis is coming in and people are doing hundreds of lights, for me, I find it difficult to maintain quality beyond around 20 lights per man. After that, it's kind of difficult to upkeep that high quality that you can if you're just running a few lights on your own and being able to pay a lot of attention. So yeah, it's that's my opinion on that one. But what was I saying? Yeah, back to the flavors. Some of the flavors that we used to get would come unnamed. There was like the skunks that were around, but also what started to happen is when things weren't quite skunky, people needed to come up with other names. So the tag that came with a lot of bud that was homegrown in the UK that was sold at a premium was crossbreed. And what that meant was some kind of hybrid, but people with a lack of knowledge of what was actually being done would refer to these strains as crossbreed. And we would get all kinds of strains. I remember like mango crossbreed. So obviously this was some kind of mango strain that wasn't quite skunky, but really had a mango expression. So that was called mango crossbreed back in the day. And that one was like super expensive compared to the import, but not quite as expensive as the skunk. So you could kind of see how the market was looking back and realizing that as growers were trying different things, they were kind of realizing where those products sat in the market and what was actually able to be charged a premium for, because they don't want to be charging small prices when they're taking a risk of growing those flavors in the UK where the prohibition exists. So yeah, I was lucky. What happened with my smoking career, as I refer to it, is that when I left secondary school and went to college, one of the two girls that I used to smoke with on a regular basis was dating a guy who was the biggest weed dealer that I've ever met up to that point. And probably even up to now, he goes down as one of the most prolific cannabis hustlers that I've ever come across in my life. And he basically, through his generosity and good supply of cannabis, turned me into the cannabis obsessed grower that I am today. Because yeah, it was him that always had so many amazing things. He had a grower link that we didn't realize at the time that just came with constant new flavors in large amounts. And I would go around and he would always just let me smoke for free. And it was only when I left and I wanted to buy a draw that I had to smoke my own bud. Whenever I was around him, he wouldn't dream of letting me roll a joint out of my own. And he would just get me super, super baked after college. And I'd end up fucking heading home super stoned, super happy, just loving life. So he would get things like different hashes. I remember him getting scuff hash at one point. I remember him getting purple power, but really well-grown purple power that was super pretty. And yeah, he had so many good flavors. And I remember one time going to his house and the guy's house just stunk so bad. He lived at home. and the whole house stunk. As I went into his bedroom, he shut the room door behind me super fast and was just in panic mode. He had about 10 fucking cartons of Glade air freshener on the floor. He'd been spraying that shit like a maniac trying to kill the smell, but whatever strain of skunk his buddy had bought him, it was one of the stinkiest strains I've ever experienced in my life. The way the guy bought the plants, it was so obvious at this stage that this was grown here because he literally packed it on the stalks. It was big, long colas, all still on the stalk, but super bright green, like a luminous green. And the smell was just so aggressive that he had like quadruple bagged it, put it into a speaker, taped up the speaker, done everything he could. Was going crazy with Glade air fresheners, but still his mum could smell it and he's having to fucking phone one of his friends who was on his way to pick up the fucking bag and hide it at his house because his mum just wasn't willing to accept it. And it's like, I think his mum knew that he sold weed, but the smell was just so aggressive, she just weren't willing to have it in her house. So yeah, that was one of my early positive experiences with like super high quality homegrown cannabis. And I guess that in a certain way started sowing those seeds of like, this is possible to do. There's crazy, incredible things out there that people are growing and smoking. And it gave me a thought of like, yeah, maybe this is something I can get into. And at that stage, it was just your mission. Anyone who's a good smoker knows that it was always your mission to be that guy that when people wanted good bud, they knew you were the guy. So I made it my mission wherever I went to get the best possible flowers that I could. A massive game changer in the hunt for flavors was my first trip to Amsterdam, which happened when I was like 15 or 16. But that really deserves its own episode. So I'm going to kind of leave that and I won't go into too much detail about what I discovered and all the revelations of going to Amsterdam at such a young age did. But as you can imagine, it was like the first time that you really saw strain names and you knew for 100% that that is what the strain was. So it kind of sent me back to England with more hunger to find those kind of things available to me in England. So Amsterdam had a very positive effect and definitely made me more of a connoisseur and made me more eager to find the best of the best. Another positive thing that came on the scene was around 99, I think it must have been. I know it was before the millennium, but I think it was, but these years are always like, it might have been 98, 99, somewhere around that period then, honey oil came onto the scene. One of my friends, his dad basically, was getting honey oil. So for a good while, we were getting honey oil. And it was almost a year we must have been getting honey oil for consistently. And initially, the amounts weren't there and it was only available in grams. And we were paying like, I think maybe £40 a gram back then. And that was like insane to even think that. But the amount we would use and how high we get in comparison to the other things that we were smoking was just mind-boggling. We would literally just like everyone started carrying like a tiny little like 1-inch knife on them so that they could have the oil and spread it on Rizzlers, fill it with tobacco and roll them up. And even though it was stuffed with tobacco and you were just smearing it on the rolling paper, it still got you blazed. I just remember being so smashed from those. It was literally like a revolution of getting whacked from honey oil. And it was good quality honey oil as well, like as far as you could tell. Like to start with, it was beautiful, clean honey oil. Like we had no real clue about how it was even made back then. But I could tell from even my knowledge now that the first batches we were getting were actually half decent. They were a good colour. They weren't too harsh. I don't remember no headaches or anything like that. So it was relatively good. But as time went on and when we tried to buy larger amounts, the guys who were doing it must have fucked up because they gave us a much, much darker quality product at one time. And it was like licorice. It came out super black. They had like soaked the material for too long, and it just pulled everything off. It was like they were giving us Rick Simpson oil, and the one before was like super clear, transparent honey oil. So it was a big letdown. And then literally it went on where it was like hit and miss, but mostly hit for like a good year. And then those people, whoever was supplying it, just dropped off the map. They were never seen again. So I always wonder who it was, where the material was from, what method they were using, all of those kind of things. Because, yeah, to think back at 98, 99, we were getting honey oil is pretty fucking incredible. It's like,
I got a joint here, man. I've been saving for a special occasion.
A big discovery around this point in my life was head shops, because that was when I first came into contact with literature, seeing like grow books and magazines, Red Eye magazine, Weed World magazine, High Times magazine, all of these different things were available, and I'd never seen so much before. Obviously, I was aware of a lot of strains from going to Amsterdam and reading coffee shop menus and seeing a few different things out there. But as far as literature, we never had the internet back then. What internet we did have, it was like at home, it was so slow, you couldn't find anything out. And in college, where I used to go on the internet most of the time, you couldn't go on searching about cannabis or anything like that. I don't even think it would have been in my mind in 97 to search about cannabis on the internet. It was like the internet was so new then. I don't even think I'd thought about that application and like that information being on there at that time. It wasn't until later on that I got onto the internet and when I started growing properly. So yeah, during those times, it was more about like getting magazines and learning as much as I could. And that's when I started to realize, like, compared to my other friends who were smokers, you started to see that for me, it was more of a passion, an obsession, a love, however you want to word it. But you started to see the difference where I was more interested in just smoking it and feeling the effects. I wanted to know all about it and read everything I could get my hands on at that time and was just super intrigued to get more information. And then that reminds me, like my friends, the ones I used to smoke with, they had an uncle that was blind and he had a book that was a grow book, and he would get us to read little bits from it to him and check things for him. And if I remember correctly, I've always like tried to think back, and it's not until later in life that I realized I think that was one of Mel Frank's books. Because of the cover, it was one of the original covers with just a little drawing on the front. And yeah, that was a super important thing as well, because to actually see it all written down in a book and see the sections, like it was overwhelming for me. I'm not going to lie, at that age, it was overwhelming. But just to look through the beginning of the book with all the chapters and just see it broken down and see that there was a procedure and a way that you could actually get yourself growing and have your own plants and produce your own bud. Because although I'd seen my friend's dad do it, it was like, it was in comparison to the good bud that we were now seeing, the stuff that he grew outdoors in England was just bushweed. Like, it was terrible. You wouldn't dream of smoking it now, but as a 15-year-old, it was fucking bliss. I literally loved it. So I don't want to talk bad about it, but yeah, it was not like great quality. So yeah. As a kid, I think you kind of build up this picture in your mind that growing is some kind of big scientific laboratory thing. And in order to get the results of like the import skunk that we were seeing, you had to be some kind of like genius to do it. And it was like, as soon as you started seeing magazines and books and you'd see little like photos submitted by growers into magazines and you'd see all the different pictures in books, you started to get the cogs in your brain started to go, to think to yourself like, wait a minute, could I be doing this? Could I grow my own bud? Is that possible? And yeah, that was kind of like the start started to happen, of like the wheels of motion in my mind started to happen in my late teens, when I started to just become more and more obsessed with different strains and trying different varieties of cannabis, and then thinking about, oh, someone actually grows all these different things. That's when I first probably was inspired to even think about it.
That's some heavy shit, man.
One of the interesting things you had to deal with growing up and being a smoker is the perception that people have of you. Sadly, people have got a negative perception, and it used to be a lot worse than it is now of cannabis. Now, at least we have a lot of actual evidence of all the benefits of it, so it's not demonized as much. But back in the 90s when I was smoking, even people that didn't really have an issue with cannabis still had a lot of preconceptions and negative things that they believed about it. So, you know, that people would think that it makes you lazy. And I quickly learned the reason that people would think that kind of thing. And what actually happened with me is that my best friend, who started smoking with me at pretty much the same time, he became the kind of smoker that would use it as an excuse not to do things, given an opportunity to get out of doing something. So he's the kind of person that if I said to him, look, bro, can you drive me to this person? I need to buy some weed. I'll give you a spliff. He would get up, no matter how stoned he is, and drive me. But if his mum said to him, can you pick up your sister from school? He would be like, oh, I just smoked a joint, I can't drive. And then slowly his mum, who had allowed him to smoke cannabis in the first place, had a negative perception of it and used to get annoyed when he was smoking. And you could see that it was building up resentment from her that he smoked, because he was using it as an excuse and as a crutch for all of the laziness and fuck-ups that he would do. So if he smashed something, he'd be like, oh, sorry, I'm stoned. Oh, I can't go nowhere. Oh, I've been smoking. So he gave his mum such a negative perception of smoking that there was kind of like a little bit of a backlash that even fed through to my mum, because they were best friends. So I made a point of making sure that I was never, ever, ever going to use it as an excuse not to do anything. I made sure that I was the kind of person that tried to change people's perception. And that's what I did for sure, because my dad didn't have really any preconceptions about cannabis other than maybe makes you more lethargic and all of these kind of things. So when I would work with him, I would make a point of working super hard to show him, like, look, I like smoking when I'm at work, but I will never ever let that affect my work rate or use that as an excuse not to do anything or for a mistake that I've made. That's just not my character. So yeah, I've always been conscious, even from a young age, of trying to change the perception that people have about cannabis users, because it's never been great. And I was quick to realize that, yeah, it doesn't, maybe not everyone, but it doesn't affect me in a negative way. It improved a lot of aspects of my life and my behavior and who I am as a person in general. So for me, it was super beneficial. And I've always kind of been the person who said that out. And even as a kid, I would tell people, like, all the stories you would hear about cannabis being medicine, how it can be a material, and all of these little whispers and things that you started to find out about and see reference to, I would spout all of that and say all of these kind of things. So yeah, I was that kind of person, and I wanted people to realize it was a good thing and not a negative thing. One of the things I always say to people when they say about cannabis being a gateway drug is this. I say, if you tell someone from when they're a baby that all fruit is dangerous, and then all of a sudden they get to the age of 16 or 17 and they try a strawberry, they're not going to stop at a strawberry. Curiosity is going to get the better of them. Not all of them, but some of them. And after strawberries have gotten a little bit boring, then they might think, they lied to me about strawberries. What about raspberries? What about watermelon? What about oranges? What about apples? And that's what I think it is sometimes. They demonize certain drugs so much that It's not like it's a gateway. The reality is that the biggest gateway drug is alcohol. The times when I fucking really done stupid shit and my inhibitions are really down is when I do alcohol. Smoking cannabis doesn't make you say, oh yeah, maybe the next step is crack cocaine. Maybe I should try some heroin. It's like, that's not a gateway, but there is a danger if you class it in with all of these other drugs that people are going to get confused when they realize that cannabis isn't bad and isn't so dangerous and they have a good time with it. Are they then going to look at the other drugs that are in that same kind of bracket and say to themselves as kids, well, is this just adults lying to us because they don't want us to have fun? Is this adults lying to us because they don't know what's fun? Like, what is the situation? So, yeah, I think it's very important to separate these things and make sure that kids realize that, yeah, cannabis isn't terrible. It's not a demonic thing. It can be used as a medicine, but it's not appropriate for kids at a young age while their brain's developing. And if you give them the information and put it in a situation like that, as we've seen in places like Holland from as far back as I can remember, the statistics do show that children are smoking less in places like Holland than they are in places like England, where prohibition exists and curiosity makes it even more an enticing prospect. So that's often the reason kids get into these things. I know for a fact myself, when I grew up smoking, I had two younger sisters around me. And because they were around me, not only smoking, but me growing, when people came to school and had weed and were smoking with all their friends and all excited, it was so like a non-event for my sisters because they'd seen so much that they didn't even pay attention to these things and they didn't really have no desire to smoke. The only time one of my sisters came to me with a desire to smoke is because the girls were giving her peer pressure. And I had to explain to her, the reason these girls are giving you peer pressure to smoke is because they've done it and now they want you in that same group. It's the same type of girls that will lose their virginity, feel bad about it, and then want you to fuck your boyfriend so that you can be in the same group as them. Don't do it. Don't bow to peer pressure. And luckily she didn't. And when she got older and she was in university and she was an adult and she was having fun and exploring life a little bit, then she tried cannabis and she was always sensible about it. She knew that smoking it with tobacco was a bad thing and she had a good education with it. And what it ended up doing is meaning that as she grew up, she was someone that would try cannabis occasionally, but was never addicted to it because she didn't have a nicotine addiction and was able to choose when she wanted it. So that's how cannabis should be. It should be something that you choose to enjoy and you pick at your own leisure, not just something that you're smoking to keep up an addiction. And one of the sad things that happened is that my friend who I started smoking with, my best friend, when we started smoking more and his mum realized that he was smoking on more than just the weekends, what she thought was a good thing to do was to get him to smoke roll-ups. So he started smoking rolling tobacco instead of smoking joints. And then before too long, he turned into someone who was smoking like ounces of tobacco every day. And yeah, it was like he went from smoking 3 joints a day to smoking like 20 roll-ups a day. So yeah, that was terrible, like, to see that happen, because she started to build up a negative perception about cannabis in general because of the way he behaved and acted with it and the way he used it as an excuse. So that in turn made her try and convince him to move away from it and ended up giving him a severe tobacco addiction. And then it wasn't long after that that I started growing and had completely given up tobacco, because for me, it was giving up tobacco that led me to start growing, amongst other things that influenced me. But that was one of the key factors that got me to grow.
Talk it out, man.
I guess one of the most fun things about living in London is the number of people there mean that there's so many different people from so many walks of life, and also so many nationalities, that you're always finding new people to smoke with and new people with new flowers. everywhere I went, whether it be a job, a social activity or anything like that, I would always be like able to just tune in to who the other smokers were. I think it's the same with all smokers. You just have that vibe where you're constantly like looking for the signal. Some little like someone will ask you like, oh, do you have any Rizla? And it's like, oh, that's it. You know, there is like, you're like, oh, king size. And if they want king size, then it's like, yeah, that's it. We've got through the like the little gentle, are we on the same page code, and got to the fact, all right, you want king size Rizla. You've got king size Rizla. We're both smoking weed. Let's go do this. So that's always interesting. You know, you kind of, you meet some cool people, whether you're like out fucking at a party or at a new job, I would always meet some amazing people. And those would always lead to like a new link and someone that had something new. And it would always be cool because that's how these things spawned, and you found the new latest flavors from a different area and got to try something different. I had many links like that over the years. I did a few little jobs. I worked on the buses, and there was one guy that I worked with that me and him used to smoke all the time. Man, I used to smoke on the bus before work. I used to smoke off the bus when I was on my break. It was crazy. Some of the things I'd done was just, yeah, borderline insane. The main guy that I used to smoke with, we met on the main training day. And I swear to you, we used to smoke in the staff room where the managers would come in sometimes, and we would have smoked it out. And it was just hot boxed full of smoke. And one time the guy came in, one of the inspectors who's like our superior, and he come in and there was literally still smoke in the air. And he looked at my friend. And my friend was one of those people that when he smoked, he got red eye so bad that there was no mistaking it. Like anyone looked at him knew that he had been smoking. And yeah, this one time I remember the inspector coming in and just looking at me, and I just looked at him and just said, hello, just like nice and calm looking, not so red eyed. He looked at my friend, and my friend's eyes are so red. The guy just straight said to him, why are your eyes so red? And I swear to you, it was like November, and my friend looked him dead in the face and goes to him, hay fever. And then just looked at me and said, you ready to go? And we fucked off out of there. So yeah, that was one of the funny little experiences as a smoking bus driver. But honestly, for me to do that job and enjoy it and not take it personally and just hate my life, smoking was almost essential. It was like a necessity. I had to have Red Bull and I had to have weed. And with those two things, I could get through the day. You're dealing with so many fucking idiot drivers and crazy people and rude people that if you aren't stoned and super zen and able to just look at that whole situation like it's a sociology experiment, that little glass window where the bus was for that one year that I drove a bus, that was like a TV for me. I sometimes would have headphones in, but just be listening to people's conversations because it's just hilarious the shit they come up with. One of the most fucked up experiences during my time of driving the bus was basically through my own stupidity. For probably the first 6 months that I was working there, whenever I was doing a morning shift, which started at like 4 or 5 in the morning, we had to pick up the bus from the depot in Wembley and drive it to like a shopping centre called Brinkcross, which was like the starting point for the bus route. So what I used to do, in my mind, I'd convince myself that by opening both the doors on the bus, because it was a single-decker bus, I would open both the doors, smoke a joint while I was driving to the first stop, but halfway there, I would stop smoking the joint, carry on airing the bus out, and then when I got near the shopping centre, I would pull up around the corner and smoke the rest of the joint. And in my mind, when you're young and stupid, you'll justify anything in your own mind. So I just convinced myself, because it suited me to do it, I convinced myself that I was doing it sufficiently to air the bus out and it not smell of cannabis. So for months and months, I did that. And then one day I get the bus. No one jumps on the bus at Brent Cross. No one gets on the bus at the second or third stops. So I'm about 5 or 6 stops into the route. and I pull into Golders Green train station. And as I pull into the train station, there's this one guy at the bus stop. He gets on the bus, and rather than pay for the bus or show me a bus pass, he does what every other police officer that gets on public transport used to do, and just shows his warrant card, which is his like police ID. So I basically fucking shit myself at this point. I just knew that the bus smelt of weed, yeah, because as the guy walked down the bus, he stopped and did a slow turn around with like a look on his face of like suspicion. So now I'm super paranoid. As we're driving the rest of the route, I decided that this guy is going to go to work, get the rest of his fucking colleagues and come and bust me on the return route. So as we're coming through Hornsey, heading towards Finsbury Park, I literally saw the guy get off the bus. Everyone else was still getting on and off of the bus. He crossed over the road and literally stood on the corner where I turned the bus. And as I went down that turning, he just looked at me and stared me dead in the face and watched me drive off. So at this stage, I'm thinking to myself, fuck. This is on top. I've already, while I've been driving along, got the weed out of my jacket and balls that because I was so paranoid. So now what I did is I just drove the rest of the route, got to Finsbury Park's train station. And once I got to Finsbury Park's train station, instead of fucking going back on the route, in case that police officer was there with a few of his colleagues, I just put out of service on the bus, completely dodged our whole route and just went back to Brent Cross early and fucking stashed everything because I was too paranoid. Whether he was there or not, I'll never know because I didn't go back to find out. By the time I did get back on the route, there was no sign of him or any of his colleagues. And that was the last day that I ever smoked on the bus. It was around this time in my life that I decided to give up tobacco. And the real reason that I gave up tobacco was going on holiday to Cyprus. It was the first time that I'd ever been away and not been able to get cannabis. And I found myself out there partying, drinking, desperately craving tobacco. And when I tried to smoke cigarettes, it made me physically sick. So I was so frustrated, it started to ruin my holiday, but it made me so determined that when I got back, I was going to give up tobacco. So eventually I come home and not straight away, but the thought was in my mind and I was on top of that whole like mindset of I need to give up tobacco. And within a month, I gave up. And this is all I did was literally just stop. Except for my one joint in the evening for the first week, the evening time was the hardest giving up the tobacco because when I tried to go like without tobacco and smoke pure, the effects of the cannabis were so distinct and so alarming to me rather than just having the relief and the narcotic effect of a tobacco mixed joint that really most of the effect is coming from the release of the craving for nicotine. So you don't notice the intricacies of the high of the cannabis that you're smoking. So when I was trying to give up, my heart was going like crazy. My head was spinning. I was like super, super high, but not able to sleep because it was almost like a sensory overload for me before going to bed rather than relaxing me. So that took me a few days where I was just smoking tobacco in the evening. I was using nicotine gum during the day. And then literally within 2 weeks, I gave up tobacco fully and I was just smoking like commercial import flower. And for a few months, I just smoked that. But it got to the point where I was having to buy such large amounts to sell it so that I could afford to smoke how much I was smoking because I was smoking a lot of joints of it because it wasn't really getting me as high as I wanted. And I was putting large amounts in joints and I couldn't really afford to smoke pure joints of really nice, well-grown, homegrown or imported like name strain skunks and all of those kind of things. So yeah, that was the catalyst for me to then start growing was the fact that now I was smoking pure and I needed my own good quality smoke because the rate I was going through it and the prices that it cost, I couldn't keep that up for much longer. I'm just a lumberjack, and I don't work for nobody but you. I'm just a lumberjack, and I don't work for nobody but you. Open my temperature rise, and then I go for her thighs. Well, folks, that's the end of that episode. I hope you've all enjoyed it. Hopefully this sounds all okay. I'm still getting the hang of all the equipment, and I'm sure as time goes on, everything is going to improve, the production level, the sound quality, all of those things. I'll get a little bit more experienced. If you see me repeating certain things and saying the same thing again and again to bridge sentences or anything like that, feel free to let me know, because I listen to podcasts a lot myself and I know it can be annoying when people repeat shit. So give me a heads up, save me from making a mug of myself if you do hear anything like that. I hope this episode's inspired you a little bit, rekindled a few old memories of your own, and hopefully I'll hear from a few of you and we'll do some episodes and put down some historical records of cannabis users in the prohibition era. Anyway, take care, guys. Look forward to hearing from you all on Instagram. Don't be shy to hit me with a message with any questions, suggestions, or just to say hi.
Light it up, let's get Chinese eyes, man.
What kind of joint is this, man?
Oh, it's a heavy duty joint, man.